The Progressive Radio News Hour with Stephen Ledman, Thursdays at 11 a.m. and weekends at 1 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome to the Progressive Radio News Hour. I'm Steve Ledman. Got two guests today. A little later in the program, Adrian Salbucci will be on. Adrian is a researcher. He's an author, a journalist, a speaker, an international consultant on political and public risk management. And he's done all kinds of things, including holding top management posts in major multinational risk management companies. We're going to talk about major world issues that Adrian has been focusing on in his writing, in some of the talks or interviews that he's given. First, I want to begin the program with Hassan Ghani. Hassan is a journalist. He's a documentary filmmaker. He's of Pakistani origin. He's currently working for Press TV. Last May 2010, he was aboard the Mavi Marmara flotilla ship bringing humanitarian aid to Gaza when Israeli commandos attacked it and murdered 9 people on board. He was broadcasting live from the ship as Israeli soldiers were descending onto the deck. I know they came down from helicopters. I wrote about it a number of times in the aftermath. Oh, did I ever write about it, including the UN report, the fudged Israeli report, the second UN report that faked the information. And there was a UN human rights report that covered it accurately. It was murder, plain and simple. Anyway, Hassan was there. He was on the most recent mission earlier in November, Freedom Waits to Gaza. I wrote about that as well. Oh, excuse me. Seem to have a frog in my throat when your time comes around. But Hassan was on the ship. Israeli commandos intercepted it again. Nobody was killed, but the people on board were arrested. They were roughed up. They were put for a short time into an Israeli prison. Hassan was held, and we want to talk about that mission. Hassan, I welcome you to the program.
Thank you.
Explain your experience on the Freedom Waves to Gaza mission. Which boat were you on? Were you on the Canadian boat or the Irish boat? Oh, you were on the Irish boat.
I was on the Canadian boat, the Tahrir.
Oh, you were on the Canadian boat. Oh, I'll be there.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
Because you're based in the UK.
Yeah. Well, the Irish boat was exclusively had Irish nationals, and they had a limit to the capacity they could carry. So I was on the Canadian boat. Most of the media, in fact, all of the media, Democracy Now!, Press TV, Al Jazeera, and an Egyptian journalist from Al Masroyan, the Egyptian newspaper, we were all on the Canadian boat, and we saw events unfold from there.
Now, everybody was arrested, right?
Everybody was arrested, but for journalists, they had an opt-out in which if you signed a document admitting to having illegally entered Israel and absolving the Israeli authorities of any kind of wrongdoing and ensuring that you wouldn't appeal legally against their arrest and deportation, if you signed a document saying that, you would be released as a journalist. But I decided not to sign it simply because I wouldn't confess, or I wouldn't sign a confession to a crime I didn't believe I'd committed, and a crime that doesn't even make sense. We were headed to Gaza through international waters, had no intention whatsoever to go to Israel. In fact, the activists who refused to disembark the boat at Ashdod port and refused to walk onto Israeli land were beaten and dragged off their boat onto Israeli land. So I wouldn't sign a confession to something that a kind of a nonsensical allegation.
Hassan, this is the way a rogue state operates. Israel committed high seas barbarism, piracy, intercepting a ship heading for Gaza, not Israeli territory, but Gaza, Palestinian territory. International water interception was illegal. Doing it at all was illegal. Forcing people into Israel and then wanting them to sign a confession that they entered the country illegally, et cetera, and so on, absolving Israel for its crimes. Well, that's the way Israel operates all the time. I guess they roughed everybody up. I assume they gave you a working over, too.
Well, they did, and initially when they boarded the ships, we were about 45 nautical miles from the coast, and when they came on, they were told repeatedly over the radio that there would be absolutely no resistance to them should they come on. When they came on, they used water cannon on our boat. They used two water cannons on either side of the Irish boat. In fact, they flooded it with so much water that the electrical generator on board short-circuited and went on fire, and the boat even, you know, there was a risk of the boat sinking. And that was despite being told by both boats they wouldn't face any resistance. When they came on to the Tahrir, they then tasered David Heap from Canada because they told him to get back. He was already up against the wall. He couldn't go any further back, but he was tasered anyway. And the first thing they did after that was grab the cameras from all the journalists. And I mean, for me personally, the most outrageous thing is that Israel calls itself a democracy, but they spent an hour and a half to 2 hours searching me because I was a journalist, because they knew I'd be trying to get some footage out. And they didn't stop searching me. They repeatedly x-rayed my clothing. The little clothing that I was allowed to take out, I wasn't allowed to take any electronic items with me. My camera is still in Israel somewhere. They searched me for an hour and a half to 2 hours. At one point, there were 10 people going through my clothing. And eventually, they found the memory cards containing the footage of their attack. And they were angry with me for having the audacity of trying to get the footage out. And this is a country that calls itself a democracy, essentially censoring the media, not just censoring the media, but completely silencing the media. And then they were filming themselves, and they obviously released edited short highlights, which, you know, complemented their narrative of what happened.
Oh, exactly, Hassan. They do this. It was a terrible scenario that played out in the aftermath of the Mavi Marmara incident. Israel actually filmed a fake account of how that attack took place. They had, as I understand it, I'm trying to remember what I wrote going back to May 2010, but I believe they recreated a replica of the Mavi Marmara ship, but there were obvious signs that it was not the ship, and they filmed something that was completely different than what in fact happened. And of course they brutalized people on board unarmed, accused them of bringing arms, there were no arms, made all kinds of false accusations. You're right, Hassan. Israel is no democracy. It never really was a democracy, certainly not one where non-Jews are concerned, and especially Arabs, especially Muslims. Palestinians have no right in occupied Palestine. Israeli Arabs, Israeli citizens, 20% of the population, have virtually no rights. Israeli politicians like Avigdor Lieberman, the foreign minister, treats them as a fifth column threat, a national security threat. 20% of the population, a fifth column threat. They simply want to be treated like anybody else. They're human beings. Tell me this, Hassan. What happened? They put you, what was the name of the prison they put you and the others in?
It was Givon prison,
which is right.
In the town of Ramle, just outside Tel Aviv.
What happened at Givon prison?
Well, I mean, we were there for about a week, and there was all sorts of mind games that were being played. We were repeatedly, you know, asked to sign this document, and we refused. And actually, one of the Canadians, he had personal reasons for getting home quickly. He signed the document on the first night, and he stayed till the end. But we were told, if you sign this document, you'll go home. We were told another point, when we continued to refuse to sign it, we were told you'll be here for 2 months. We were also told you need to pay for your own flights to leave and so on. All sorts of strange things were happening. But the Irish contingent were very strong, and so initially the guards tried to lock us up in the cells for 22 hours a day, but the Irish kind of put their foot down. They held a meeting and demanded that we be allowed free association during daylight hours, and the guards kind of, I think they were kind of taken aback by this, and they did allow it. I guess we have better, despite what we went through, and it was only a week compared to the decades that some Palestinian prisoners have spent in Israeli jails, as internationals, I think we had better treatment than Palestinians and Arabs inside Israel often do.
Well, I get as bad as it could be for a few days, Hassan. I agree with you. I have written at length at what Palestinians go through in Israeli prisons, including torture. I remember an article I wrote a few years ago, and it's absolute fact. It was called Torture as Official Israeli Policy. Well, torture is official Israeli policy. It's also official U.S. policy. And there was material that I got. America made it easy for me, Hassan. I mean, there were Bush memos. All I had to do was quote from, and they simply hung themselves with what they themselves said in their memos and other material that I found. And the Israelis as well provided some information. I mean, obviously, torture is illegal. International law prohibits it under all conditions. There are no exceptions whatsoever. But the Israeli Supreme Court made a huge exception to allow Israel to do what they please to detainees referred to as ticking bombs. Well, I guess a ticking bomb, Hassan, is anybody so designated by Israel for any reason, even if there's no reason at all. And also they can put anybody in prison, including people like yourselves, literally abducted in international waters and do whatever they ever want to you. And who is going to do anything to stop them? So they do it over and over again. And if they really get caught red-handed, they get a Ban Ki-moon UN commission put together to abrogate the findings of an independent UN commission, like the Human Rights Council, to say virtually anything Israel once said,
It's interesting you mention that, because whenever we brought up the issue of legality with the Israelis, they pointed to the Palmer report. But of course,
Hassan. Oh, I think we lost Hassan. Adrian, are you on?
Yes, sir. I was listening.
Oh, I'm going to pick up with you. Something went awry with Hassan. I was about to wrap it up. Do I hear Hassan?
Don't worry, Stephen. When he gets back on the line, just carry on with him.
Well, I wanted to wrap it up rather quickly, and I was very interested in knowing what his personal experience was on this mission. It's something I've written a number of times, Adrian, about the various humanitarian missions to Gaza. The big one was 2010, the Mavi Marmara. You know all about that. And, I mean, the horrors that went on, and Hassan mentioned the Palmer report. Palmer was a former New Zealand Prime Minister, if I remember right, and that was the Ban Ki-moon put together commission, the Rigged Commission, to manipulate the results to be what Israel wanted them to be, besides its own military coming out with its own report. They always come out with their own reports, Adrian, pretty much saying whatever they want to say. In other words, they whitewash them. Oh, my goodness.
When you have power, when you have such huge power as they do, and not just power in Israel, but power in such countries like the United States and those of the European Union, you can do that because you can have your own way when you have all the strings of power in your hands. It's as simple as that.
Oh, it really is.
Look what's happening now, where they've just captured Saif Islam Gaddafi's son, and the International Criminal Court is asking for his extradition, and they will no doubt judge him unless he is lynched and assassinated before in Libya itself. And yet when you look at the International Criminal Court, which was created by the Treaty of Rome of 1998, nobody says, the mainstream media do not say, that two nations never became members of that treaty. One is the United States of America, and the other one is Israel, because they know that they would be defenseless if any of the George Bushes and Netanyahu's and Yehud Barak's and Obama's were to be judged by the International Criminal Court.
if my memory serves me right, Adrian, years back before Jesse Helms left the Senate, and I'm not certain if he's still living, I think he passed away, but when he was in the Senate, the hideous senator, North Carolina, I believe, extremist Republican neocon type, I think I remember him making a statement to the effect that if the International Court dared arrest a U.S. official, the Marines would go in and extract him forcibly from the Hague.
Well, yeah, that was an honest reply, at least.
Well, that's right. I will give credit where credit is due. If somebody at least says what they mean, I understand that. When Obama says one thing and does another, I absolutely rip my hair out.
Well, that's called hypocrisy. And, you know, they base themselves on a very old, I would say, blueprint for global domination, which uses two key words, force and hypocrisy. So, you know, every once in a while, if somebody like Jess Helms comes around and at least gives an honor, straight answer, you figure, well, at least somebody's doing it. Because otherwise, everything else is Orwellian newspeak. I mean, you know, when you look at what happened to Libya, it's just Orwellian newspeak on top of Orwellian newspeak, and that's where the mainstream Western media, the so-called mainstream Western media, have such a huge responsibility, and someday they're going to have to pay for that. Because when they started, for example, they target a country, like they did with Libya, by branding it a rogue state. Then they say that they impose UN resolutions, and they say it's a no-fly zone to protect civilians, and they rain death upon the country. Then it goes on, and they choose local terrorists, and they call them freedom fighters, until at the end they take the country over, they destroy it, and they call it liberation. I mean, it's all newspeak. It's all hypocrisy. And, you know, they know that although there's a 20, maybe 25% of the global population, you and me included and your listeners, that don't buy that, they just work on the basis that 75% of people, either because they're ignorant or they're too sluggish or they're sloth or for whatever reasons, they will passively buy it. So that's what gives them the legitimacy to do all the madness and all the crimes they're doing.
Well, that's exactly right, and who's going to stop them? You've got America really running the show. You've got NATO that includes the big Western countries, a lot of other ones. You've got Turkey. Turkey did some wonderful things taking on Israel, and they ruined it all by being part of the NATO coalition against Libya. They're doing it again right now, Adrian, against Syria. Turkey borders on Syria, and they're talking about some horrors. I mean, they're funneling in arms to these al-Qaeda types, the same ones that were sent into Libya. The same types, thousands of them probably, are attacking the government, killing security forces, killing innocent civilians, and the Assad regime is being blamed for this. When they defend themselves, Adrian, they're the ones blamed, they're the ones fingered. They're replicating the Libya model, and the only thing in my mind, Syria is has a stronger military than Gaddafi had, and NATO of course could easily subdue Syria, but do they really want another war? I think they want to either get rid of the Assad regime, or they at least want it to surrender totally to become a client state. I don't know how you can change your spots. So I guess what they really want is regime change. And if they don't get it one way, the ultimate way is simply do it belligerently. I mean, I smell another war coming in Syria. But I want to ask you one thing. You mentioned Saif Gaddafi. I saw the report this morning. We've seen it before that he was captured and other Libyans, and the reports turned out to be false. Is this one actually verified?
Well, you know, you and I are lucky, are the lucky ones that often share interviews on Russian television, on Russia Today, which is one of the few important alternative media presently available. And I remember that you had some doubts even when they spoke of the assassination of Gaddafi and now with the capture of his son. And I see your point, and I tend to leave a very open mind and a very open margin to your stance on that. Because if there is one thing that we cannot do anymore is believe the Western mainstream media. So if the Western mainstream media say, we've captured so-and-so, we've done this, we've done that, in principle, I don't believe anything they say until, I mean, they are guilty until proven otherwise. So, you know, what's happening with Saif, with Gaddafi's son, Saif Gaddafi, Islam Gaddafi, we still, I don't think the final chapter has been written yet. If he has been captured, as all the news sources seem to be saying, there are also many indications that a lot of people are greeting him as a liberator. There were large numbers of people in Tripoli with the green flag of the Gaddafi movement receiving him. So I am wondering if the final word, the final chapter, has even been written in Libya yet.
Well, you remember the last time there were reports of his capture, and I believe within 24 hours he showed up live in Tripoli. And the mainstream media had to retract what they reported, that he had been captured. There have been other Libyan officials, Gaddafi's official spokesman. He was reported captured a couple of times. One instance, Musa, you know the man I mean. I forget his exact name.
Yes, ex-foreign minister, the former foreign minister, yeah.
Is he the former foreign minister? He became the spokesman for Gaddafi. One of the times that they reported his capture, he was actually on radio live, free, while the report of his capture came in. So,
well, does that surprise you? Look, as you know, and as your listeners might probably know, I'm speaking from Argentina. That's in South America, and we have a much lighter but similar case in our region, which is Venezuela. I remember about a month and a half ago, all the major news media, Reuters and CNN, were saying, "Oh, Hugo Chavez is just about to die at any moment. Stand by, you'll be getting the breaking news that Chavez is dead." And at the same time, Chavez was in the Palacio Miraflores, which is the presidential palace in Caracas, speaking to the very reporters from Reuters and CNN and saying, "You guys are saying this, saying that, but here I am. I'm not dead. I'm answering your questions." But as I say, this was only broadcast in the regional channel Telesur in Spanish, and I think that the mainstream media know that they can lie blatantly and outright, and although there will be smaller media in other languages or even a smaller channel like RT or Press TV from Russia and from Iran, and some people will hear it, and some people will say, like you and me, "Hey guys, you guys are lying." They work on the fact that most Homer Simpsons, the world over, whether it be in America, in Europe, or in Argentina and Brazil, will just buy the local mainstream media, and they will believe all the lies that they are given. And these people don't care as long as they can get their way, even if 2, 3, 4 years down the road, it were to come out and people were to say, "Hey, these guys were lying all the time," nothing happens. I mean, look at it. Everybody knows that George W. Bush, Dick Cheney, Colin Powell, Condoleezza Rice were lying blatantly, Tony Blair, about the weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. Nobody doubts that anymore. And what does the system say? "Well, okay, but that was back in 2003. And we blew it. Sorry. Collateral damage. And let's just keep going." You know, I mean, they never backtrack.
Well,
and that's their main force. Even when they make horrendous, not mistakes, but horrendous lies, they will never say, "I'm sorry, we're going to pull out, we're going to bring back, I don't know, Saddam Hussein back in power or something."
Oh, well, I absolutely agree. People, unfortunately, most people in America, at least, I imagine in many other countries, they get their so-called news from television. And I would imagine the mainstream media in Argentina is nothing to send up three cheers about. It certainly isn't in America. It certainly isn't across Europe. The BBC is, of course, a British-owned and operated and funded news service. Public radio in America, Adrian, National Public Radio, PBS, there's nothing public about either one of them. They're funded by corporations and by Washington. And in a recent article, I do a lot of media critiques, Adrian. In a recent article, I quoted a Boston University president in 1950, saying, "If this television craze catches on, we will end up with a nation of morons."
The guy was a prophet, obviously. But you know, I often describe the problem as follows. for I don't know, 20, 30,000 years, the main instrument of education for any human being was basically his family and his immediate community, for technological reasons even. Over the past two centuries, the main instrument of education became the school, the public school, that generated a common national myth, so to speak, whether it be in Argentina or in the States or wherever. But in the last 30, 40 years, the main instrument of quote-unquote education or dumbing down has become the media, television. So people, again, their whole worldview, their whole source of information, their whole source of misinformation is the media. And as long as somebody on a television screen says, this happened, that happened, this guy is good, that guy is bad, they will believe it. And they so oversaturate us, overwhelm us with huge amounts of information that we forget that today they are saying exactly the opposite of what they said last week. People just don't join the dots. Saddam Hussein is a case at hand. During the 80s, he was really our man, our hero, fighting those dreadful Ayatollahs over in Tehran until he turned over and from being one of our guys with Donald Rumsfeld shaking his hand in Baghdad in 1980 as he was waging his war against Iran, he all of a sudden became the bad guy with the weapons of mass destruction that were never found. So in a way, you know, people nowadays, and that's the tragedy of our day and age, we are all very well informed. We have lots of information about the financial crisis, about what's happening in the Middle East, about what's happening in America and in Europe and the new prime minister of Italy and Greece. A lot of information, but we have no way, we are given no way of actually putting it together into a model. So very often, you know, I personally don't buy newspapers, ever, because I think it's the most dreadful thing you can do. You have to sort of, it's like an impressionist painting. If you get too close to a Renoir, you just see a lot of little dots, green dots, red dots, pink dots, and everything. You have to move away, and when you move away, you say, oh, this is beautiful. Now I see what the guy was driving at.
Oh, I agree, Adrian. I gave up buying newspapers so many years ago. I can't remember how long, and I just can't imagine why I ever wanted to buy them in the first place. I live in a condominium, and on my floor early in the morning, I see newspapers, Chicago Tribune, whatever, in front of people's doors. And I shake my head and I say, do people really spend good money on this stuff? I mean, there really is nothing in them worth reading. I have to do a little bit of monitoring because I do a lot of media critiques. And my number one target is the New York Times because it has global reach. So what they say can get picked up all over the world. And I'm sure they know me by now because I go at them all the time. I could make a career just out of doing damage control on their misreporting. And when I spot something they say, Adrian, that actually is accurate in a new article that I have, I picked up a marvelous piece of accurate information from them, and I ended up saying after using the quote referred to the reason people are on the streets on the Occupy Wall Street movement. And there was one quote, it was a long statement, and it was very accurate describing why these people are out there. I mean, the legitimate grievances wrapped up in one long sentence. Just about one long sentence, maybe it was two. And I made a comment after that saying, this was truly a remarkable statement by America's number one establishment broadsheet. They represent wealth and power. And for them to make a statement like this, it was the kind of statement I would be proud to put my name under. And it's almost like, it must be a misprint. I've got to go back and find the article again and read it. They didn't really say this, did they? Well, they did say it, but it's the exception that proves the rule. For the few times they do something like that, so many other times they're on the other side, literally lying through their teeth. They're just seething for another war with Libya. They are all over Iran, Adrian. I'd like to talk about both of those because they are boiling. The pot is boiling on both of them. Let's talk about Syria a little bit. I honestly smell the strong possibility that we're going to get another war there. Any thoughts? Oh, dear. Did we get cut off? Let's try to get Adrian back on the line again. Something's... I'm having no luck today. Get disconnected. Well, let's see if we can get him back on. Oh, Hassan?
Yes, I'm here.
Oh, let's do this. I was getting near the session with you. Let me let you make some final thoughts on the experience that you went through. And you report this for Press TV, which is just marvelous. Let me just say a word about Press TV. They have me on often, Hassan. We can either do it by phone, and they refer to it as a phoner. It can be maybe for 3, 4, 5 minutes. Occasionally they'll have me on phone for a longer period than that, oh, maybe 10 or 15, once in a blue moon. Maybe there's some reason they'd want to have me on longer. And at other times, I go down to a downtown Chicago studio to pick up a satellite feed to go on live, so just like going on any U.S. television channel. And again, they have me on often. The work they do is tremendous. I mean, they bring people like me on and other people I know and respect, and they deal in their analysis programs. There's one program that has me on often called News Analysis. They'll pick a topic like Syria, like the Libya war, like the IAEA report on Iran, and they'll bring on usually three guests. And generally, all three of them are marvelous. They will discuss it very accurately, so people watching and listening to this program and others on Press TV really are getting accurate information. I try never to let a day go by, Hassan, without having Press TV on at least once. I'm more concerned with listening than watching, because I want information. The visuals are a thrill for me. It's the information that I crave, and I go to Press TV for it, and I go to Russia Today for it. Generally, each of them at least once per day, and that's my daily diet. And I turn out the U.S. major media because there's no possibility in the world you'll end up being anything more than a moron, to quote the 1950 president of Boston University, if you spend your time getting information from those sources. So I salute you, Hassan, because you're part of the Press TV operation, providing accurate information to people on what really is happening, not the fake news that America's media provides, the BBC provides, the other major media across Western Europe, I guess Eastern Europe. And the good sources are few and far between. Press TV is one. Let me let you make a final comment on your experience. Well, either with Press TV or from the Freedom Waves to Gaza, Hassan.
Well, I think I'd just like to clarify a few things in that case about the Freedom Waves. I mean, for example, one of the propaganda points that Israel has tried to score on that was that there was no medical aid on board. First of all, we have to understand is that what these people were trying to do was not necessarily take humanitarian aid. What they were trying to do was open up a channel so that Palestinians can trade with the world. Palestinians don't want to be dependent on aid. They want to be able to trade without having Cairo or Tel Aviv decide where and what they can do. But there was some medical aid. There was some symbolic medical aid on board, about $30,000 worth, and it was hidden inside boxes which were labeled with hummus and melons and so on, because they didn't want the Turkish authorities to know where these boats were going initially. They didn't want any political interference. Israel said that there was no medical aid on board, and that there's only two answers to that. Either the Israelis are lying about that, or their soldiers are so incompetent that they couldn't figure out that these boxes, which say hummus on them, actually do have aid in there. And people can Google and they can see the video shot from on board the ships while they were en route, showing the boxes being opened and the aid inside. The other thing is that Israel tried to justify time and time again when we were in their custody that the Palmer report, you know, released a few months ago, legalized the blockade of Gaza. But I mean, that report aside, the UN's position has been clear in the past that the blockade is illegal. And on top of that, of course, what happened last year on the Mardi Marmara was, of course, a long time before this ruling. The Israelis have not had any concern with legality. When they killed 9 people on board the Mardi Marmara, they had no concern about legality. And I was there, and I saw how the Israelis were behaving from there. And the first person to be killed was a man named Chevdet. his job was to take photographs of what happened. And he was walking around. I saw him that night walking around with his SLR on camera, and he was shot in the forehead between the eyes. And that gives you an indication of how Israel, what the Israeli soldiers think of the media. The other thing that you have to bear in mind is that what people should know, what people should do if they really want to find out what happened on the Mavi Marmara, is simply look at the forensic evidence, look at the evidence that's been reported in the UN's report on that. It's very clear that many of the people that were killed were executed while they had already been shot. The youngest one, a dual US and Turkish national, Furkan Doğan, was shot repeatedly while he was lying on the floor, already injured. These were executions. These were not killings in self-defense. And this is the kind of behavior that people on these freedom waves, on these flotillas, failing to Israel, have to anticipate and have to be careful of and have to mentally prepare themselves for.
Well, that's right. That's exactly right, Hassan. And my understanding of the Mavi Marmara was that Israel, the commandos came on board with photographs of people targeted to be assassinated. And I remember writing about people shot and murdered at point blank range, so shot in the head. And these people were singled out to be murdered in cold blood. And Turkey was outraged. And they wanted two things, at least two things. I think Turkey is pretty upset in general, but they wanted at least two things. They wanted restitution made to the families of the murdered people. I don't know how you provide restitution when their loved one is gone. And they wanted an apology. Israel refused to apologize. They were willing to make some kind of restitution, monetary or whatever, but they refused to apologize. Again, I emphasize, this is the way a rogue state operates. Listeners to my program, Hassan, understand it very well. They understand that Gaza is illegally isolated under siege. They know all this. Hassan, let me wrap it up and just say, I'd be delighted to have you come back on this program again and discuss your firsthand experience. If you go out on another mission, I absolutely would want you to come back to talk about it, because this concerns me. I write about it. I discuss it on this program. And to have anybody come on who went through it firsthand, that really is valuable stuff for the people who listen to my program. Hassan, I thank you very much for coming on. I look forward to doing this again.
Look forward to speaking to you again, Stephen. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Adrian, I guess we're connected again.
Yes. First, we got cut off here, but congratulations for having Hassan on your program. I think his first-hand experience is so very important that he should share it with the whole world, actually, because as you just aptly said, that's the way a rogue state operates. But of course, if you're a rogue state, but you have the world superpower behind you, you're just, you know, in basic Orwellian newspeak, you're just a very legal, you're the only democracy in the Middle East, the way they brand themselves. You see, the world's problem, and you mentioned this at the beginning of the program, is that the United States of America pretty much calls the shots in what happens in our world today. But Zionism calls the shots of what happens in America. And when you join the two together, you start to understand, you know, America runs the world, Israel runs America, and everything is, well, just a foregone conclusion.
Oh, that is so true. The power of the Israeli lobby, probably the most powerful lobby in the country. And I think about that as I make that statement, Adrian, because I know the power of money, which means the power of Wall Street. But Wall Street and the Israeli lobby, they are, well, you know, they're not, one isn't an affiliate of the other, but they're so closely linked. I'm certain there are a lot of Zionists on Wall Street, but the lobby serves the Wall Street interest. So the power of money may be supreme, and the Israeli lobby, as an official lobby, or whatever they call themselves, probably is the most powerful lobby in Washington. And I have quoted the great departed Palestinian-American scholar Edward Said saying to the effect that in a matter of hours, the entire Senate, I don't even think he used the word virtually, I think he said the entire Senate in a matter of hours would come together to support, maybe he said virtually anything Israel wants. And the House, there'd be a few outliers who can get away with it, But aside from a few outliers, you could say almost the same thing about the house. So whatever the tail wants, the dog barks and obeys, and it's a very sad situation. Even when it harms U.S. interests, Adrian, I mean, America has gotten itself into a mess. Its influence is waning. It's heading itself toward bankruptcy. The way Chalmers Johnson wrote, this reckless spending, so much of it on militarism, far more than the official numbers, and all the rest of it, the trillions of dollars handed to bankers, who knows how much more given to other corporations, the looting of the country, the harming of people all over the world. You can only get away with those things so long, and then finally it comes to a bitter end, just the way it has for all other empires, and America's day is coming, Adrian. I only hope at my tender age I live long enough to see it. I hope it doesn't end in, shall I say, a mushroom-shaped cloud.
Well, you know, it unfortunately, it is coming in a way. The demise of the United States is already long in the planning, just as the demise of the former Soviet Union was in the planning for anybody who would have read Zbigniew Brzezinski's book, Between Two Ages, America's Role in the Technotronic Age, which dates back to 1971, and based on which book David Rockefeller, Henry Kissinger, and the Rothschilds founded the Trilateral Commission in 1973. Anybody who had read that book by Brzezinski, who was the ideologue of the Trilateral Commission, would have read between the lines that globalization was coming and that the system that was going to be used was Western capitalism, not communism, and that the demise of the Soviet Union was just a matter of time. 18 years later, it's exactly what happened without firing a shot. If you look at the things that have been happening in the last decade or so, 15 years maybe, you can tell that now it's the demise of the United States that is necessary, because these guys are wrapping up globalization to usher in world government. And to usher in world government, they need for the United States of America to go into the waste bin of history, just as the former Soviet Union did. And, you know, the Trilateral Commission, together with the Council on Foreign Relations, together with AIPAC, American-Israeli Public Affairs Committee, are designing the long-term planning for this. Let me give you just one short 30-second example. We know that Italy and Greece are having horrendous public debt crises. So we have a new prime minister in Greece, a gentleman by the name of Lucas Papademos, who was with the vice governor of the European Central Bank in Frankfurt, and he was the former governor of the Central Bank of Greece. He is a member of the Trilateral Commission. Let's go over to Rome. Rome now has a new prime minister, Mario Monti. Who is Mario Monti? The European chairman of the entire Trilateral Commission. I mean, these guys are putting their key people in government, in places of the highest power, in order to ensure that Italy, the Italian people, and the Greek people will do everything necessary so that the Greek state and the Italian state can pay their money and their debts. To whom? To Goldman Sachs, Citicorp, HSBC, Bank of America. I mean, it's the bankers and their power structure running the entire planet, and it's right in front of your face. But when you look at the New York Times or the Times London, they will tell you everything about Mario Monti, that he was the dean of Bocconi University, that he was this, that he was that, but they will never tell you, oh, by the way, he is European chairman for David Rockefeller's and the Rothschilds Trilateral Commission. No, they won't say that.
Well, that's exactly right. In Greece, and I wrote about this, Adrian, in Greece and in Italy, we had two elected prime ministers dismissed. Dismissed by whom? Dismissed by bankers. And who do they put in their place? They put bankers. They put unelected bankers in charge of both countries to run the countries, to be sure that bankers get paid. And how do you be sure bankers get paid? You trash individual people. You harm people. You rob from them. You harm the economy. But the number one priority of anybody leading these countries, which happens to be bankers right now, is rule number one, bankers get paid. Rule number two, don't worry about anything. Just be sure bankers get paid, no matter how much is involved. Pay them and forget about everything else. And that's the way America is run. That's the way the European economies are run. By the way, I have an article I haven't gotten out yet. I get a little bit ahead of myself. but the title of it is called Eurozone Doomsayer Got It Right. A man, the New York Times wrote an article about him, and then I looked him up and I found information. He wrote a book back in 1995 called The Rotten Heart of, a man named Bernard Connolly. He wrote a book called The Rotten Heart of Europe, subtitle, The Dirty War. War for Europe's Money. The Euro came into existence in 1998. I believe it was 1998. In 1995, he wrote this book. He was the chief economist or a financial advisor to the European Commission. They fired him on the spot when this book came out because he just railed against the system. He called the euro, among other things, a harebrained idea. And I found a few passages. I checked his book out on Amazon, by the way. You can get a used copy, and if I remember the price right, it was something like $660-odd.
Whoa.
I read about him. I read about people who wrote about him. Apparently, he is the world expert on the Eurozone system. He's out of government. He operates as a private consultant. He's very expensive, but the people who rely on his advice, investment people, hedge fund managers, people like that, they rave about him. They rave about him, his knowledge, and how to look at the system and what's going on and anticipate future events to make money on them, which is what hedge fund managers want, Adrian. And there was one man I quoted, I don't have his name in front of me, but he said, talking to Bernard Connolly is like spending 4 years at Harvard.
Well, exactly. Stephen, let me give you just a little bit from my region, a little bit of historical perspective, which I know you love to do on your show. Exactly, and I mean exactly 10 years ago, in November 2001, Argentina collapsed. And why did Argentina collapse? Because our government had deficit zero imposed upon it, and that meant unemployment, no health services, no education. It was one great big chaos. Who was the economy minister at that time? A guy by the name of Domingo Cavallo. He is the only Argentinian member of the Trilateral Commission, and he was put in power as economy minister by David Rockefeller and William Rhodes from Citibank, who personally visited Buenos Aires and personally visited then-President Fernando de la Rúa at the presidential palace to tell him, Mr. President, you must name our boy, Domingo Cavallo, as finance minister. That was in March 2001. In November 2001, Argentina collapsed completely. It's the same story over and over and over again.
Oh, it sure is, and I remember those years, and I remember Cavallo, and of course Argentina ended up doing the right thing, Adrian. They made their bondholders take a pretty sizable haircut, and they got themselves out from under after going through some pain, and that's what Greece and Italy and the other troubled European economies need to do. What they should have done is never gotten into the Eurozone, which was a failed idea from the beginning, but they've got a horrendous mess on their hands. They never should have put bankers in charge of their country. And what they need to do is get out of the Eurozone, get control of their own monetary and fiscal policy, be able to,
right,
especially Greece, be able to devalue their currency and become competitive again. Worry about their economies, worry about their working people, and forget about the bankers. And if they did that, they'd go through a couple of years of pain, and they'd be on the road to recovery, just the way Argentina did. If I remember right, Adrian, once Argentina got back on its feet for a couple of few years early in the new millennium, they had the highest growth rate in Latin America. Isn't that right?
And we still do, probably right now. The thing is that Argentina is so immensely wealthy and rich in its natural resources and so forth, such a huge territory, such a small population, that no matter what our politicians do to try to sink it, it just pops up back again. And, you know, it's a sad case, and I'm really working very hard at this in my own country, mind you, because Argentina is probably the country in the world that could set a hell of an example for everybody else. And I'll tell tell you why. Because Argentina's sovereign debt can be traced back, it's complicated, but it can be traced back to a debt that was originally contracted by an illegal military civilian regime that usurped power in 1976 until 1983, supported by the State Department and the CIA. So the origin of our foreign debt, our so-called public debt, is illegal and illegitimate, something that Greece and Italy and all the European countries cannot say because they were all taken by formerly democratically elected government. We could do that, and the system works so well that they have ensured that ever since Argentina came back to so-called democracy in 1983, not one single government of any political color, including the present government, has said, we're going to investigate the origin of Argentina's foreign debt, and that which is legitimate, we're going to pay. And that which can be traced back to the debt that was contracted between the bankers and the military in 1976, 77, 78, we will not pay it. But they have such a stranglehold over our political system, our media, and even over the people that no government would dare do that. And if a really sovereign president were to do that, he would probably be either shot, killed, thrown out, or whatever.
Oh, I think that's very, very likely. Let's do this. We're getting near the end of the program, and on my mind was to talk about the possibility of more war in the Middle East. Let me get your thoughts on Iran and Syria. Very much are on my mind. I think it would be insane to go to war with Iran. It might be a little less insane, but possibly insane to take on Syria as well. The idea of totally throwing the entire region into turmoil is a possibility, and I think there are level-headed people in America, and in Israel for that matter, that want no part of a war with Iran. I don't know what they feel about Syria. What are your thoughts on the possibility of a war against one or both of them?
Well, let me take a very quick crack at this because I know there's a little time left in the program. First of all, ever since the debacle of Israel in southern Lebanon in 2006, they have been saber-rattling ever since, saying every other day, we're going to invade them, we're going to kill them, we're going to do this, we're going to do that. Now Britain and France and the United States are tagging along. It's like the boy that cries wolf. We don't quite know when it's coming, but I think it is soon going to be coming, especially since it is a window of opportunity that Israel now desperately needs because their situation is almost untenable, especially if America starts pulling out of Iraq, for example, as they might start doing next year. Now, that being said, I think that Israel is the wild card. Israel will probably make a unilateral attack, even against the wishes of America and the European Union. And when that happens, all hell will break loose because Iran, especially, is neither Iraq or Libya that were just stood in the middle in the crossfire. Iran has the commercial backing of China that desperately needs its oil, and the commercial and probably military backing of Russia. Now, the nuts who are running this world government might really want and seek to find a controlled World War III in order to be able to kick the chessboard and start all over again, which might be to their benefit, as they did in 1938-39 with World War II. Let me just add one little point, which is typical of how the media handle this. We are all told that Iran has a military program. If I were an Iranian leader, and if you were an Iranian leader, and you had Afghanistan to the west, Iraq to the east, Israel threatening to nuke you every other day, it's natural that you would have to take defensive measures. Now, that being said, in the last 100 years, and no media will tell you this, in the last century, Iran, or Persia, as it was formerly known, has not invaded or attacked anybody. However, during World War I, they were invaded twice by Britain. During World War II in 1941, they were invaded by Britain and the Soviet Union because they needed Iranian oil to fight against Hitler. In 1951, they choose a democratically elected president, a guy by the name of Mohammad Mossadegh, who nationalizes the Anglo-Iranian Oil Company, better known today as British Petroleum. What does the CIA and MI6 do? They orchestrate a coup, they get rid of Mossadegh, and they impose on the poor Iranian people more than a quarter century of the former Shah Reza Pahlavi, who was absolutely authoritarian and repressive. They get rid of him in 1979 with the Ayatollahs. What do the Western powers do? They arm Saddam Hussein to the teeth, including weapons of mass destruction, chemical weapons of mass destruction, and they support Saddam Hussein's Iraq in a fratricidal, in fact, a genocidal war against Iran. So when you look at this, you figure it's Iran that's been attacked time and again by the so-called Western powers, and they in turn have been very prudent, and they have attacked nobody.
Well, I agree 100%. We're talking about Iran. Syria is very much in the spotlight as well. What do you think about the possibility? I mean, I think a broader war. I recognize the possibility of going for a general war, Adrian. You can call it a general war or another world war. There's no question that Russia and China have big interests. Russia has a military base. It's only Mediterranean bases in Syria at a Syrian port, and they're very concerned. China certainly wants access to Iranian oil. It looks like they've lost access to Libyan oil, but China, I'm certain, wants to keep access to Iranian oil. So they're both very much tied into this. I don't think they would ever let a UN resolution go through that could lead to war, just like the one against Libya, the so-called no-fly zone that I quoted a U.S. general saying before that resolution passed, that if it did pass, the military, NATO, whatever, would have to take out Libya's command and control system. Well, the general was announcing that if you pass this resolution, we're going to bomb Libya. And that's exactly what happened. So it really, that resolution was not a no-fly zone. It was a declaration of war where Russia and China want no repeat because they have bigger fish to fry apparently in Syria and certainly in Iran. But the sabers are rattling. Like you, I have heard it time and again. Time and again, I look for the body language, Adrian. I try to distinguish what's different now than what happened before. Something big is different in Syria. We've got this armed insurgency replicating the Libyan model going on, not in Iran, right, but in Syria. That's the one I'm focusing on most, and that's the one where I fear, very possibly, belligerence could break out. Do you sense it yourself?
I agree with you because Syria would be easier and more justifiable to take down, and it would really be a launching pad against Iran. I mean, Iran is the final objective, but very likely Syria will be the next intermediate stop, so to speak. And the whole Arab Spring engineered uprisings are part of the general turmoil that they need to have throughout the entire Middle East in order to say, okay, all these countries are so concerned with our own internal problems, with the collapse of Egypt, which is still collapsing today, with the collapse of Libya, that they're not going to be able to bunch up and gang up to support any state that is attacked by ourselves. As we saw in Libya, where the entire Arab world, whether for or against Libya, did absolutely nothing to help. So, again, I think that probably, as we all know, Israel has this so-called Samson factor, which they say if we were ever put up against a corner, we'll just unleash a great war, and if Israel disappears, the whole Middle East will disappear. Well, I think that we're seeing the Samson factor, not just for the Middle East, but maybe for the entire world. I mean, the whole world today is being held ransom by a very tiny but extremely powerful usurping minority over interests which might be regional for some place like the Middle East, for example, or even geostrategic, but they definitely are not of such importance to the entire planet. And if we have a world war, well, it's going to affect Africa, Latin America, the Far East, everybody.
Well, I was about 5 years old when World War II began. I think it began on or about the day I entered kindergarten, Adrian. Obviously, I was too young to have any idea what was going on, and I didn't. And there was no television in those days. I absolutely do remember World War II because my dad, every evening when he came home, he wanted to hear the news, and that's what was on the radio. And I remember the people who broadcast it, a lot different from today. But I remember the names, and I remember listening, and I remember thinking as a very young boy, gee, I wish they'd get this war over with so I could go back to Terry and the Pirates and Superman and the things that I want to listen to. But some of that came on in the afternoon, so at least I had some of it. But now I'm very mindful of the possibilities, and World War III very much could be a possibility. The thing that concerns me, and we're just about out of time, is that the economic situation isn't getting better. It's deteriorating, and the anger on U.S. streets and on Western streets across Europe. The anger is very, very great. Literally, there are sparks there that could erupt into a revolution. What better way to distract people, Adrian, than scaring them, manufacturing another enemy and having another war, and make people worry more about their safety than their economic well-being, even though we're facing another bald-faced lie and another war that shouldn't be fought. Adrian, let me just wrap it up with that and say to you, I hope I can get you back very soon to continue this, because I'd like to get more of your thoughts on what's going on. You follow it. I do all the time. Feature it on this program a lot. But your views are very important, and I eagerly look forward to having you back again so we can have another go at this. Big stuff.
Whenever you say, my good friend, you just let me know the date and the time, and I'm there for you.
Oh, Adrian, I really appreciate that. I will shoot you an email as soon as I get off air, and I very much enjoyed today's program. I indeed look forward to having you back again. And I'll just remind listeners, on weekends, Saturday and Sunday, always on 1 p.m. Eastern Time, also on Thursday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time. And as I say every week, make it a regular habit.